Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to part two of episode 20 with Will Nash. If you are just listening and haven't listened to part one, stop and go and listen to part one straight away. Otherwise, this will be confusing and you won't be getting the whole story and it won't be in order. Duh. So go and check out episode 20, part one. And if you've listened to part one, I'm glad you're listening to part two. It's brilliant. And as I said before, tons of detail about what we do, what Will does in the movie industry and what everyone does. And all based around me jumping into a swimming pool film set. How's that for intriguing? Check it out and subscribe, leave a review, check it out on Twitter at Ben Stewart PCast. No, Create More PCast. And thank you so much for listening. Bye. So then you buried a body, deleted the footage, and we'll never talk about it again.
Yeah, I miss her.
Yeah,
but she was a frog.
Yeah. So anyway, we're back again. Yeah. Now I feel like I can justify a two-parter because we have gone out and got a beer.
Yeah, a shandy.
A man shandy.
A man
no,
shandy.
That sounds terrible.
A man shandy.
So we'll get back to the films you made later, but later.
Later, yeah, God, we haven't got to
get sleep. So, but what I do want to know is, we'll start this off, is like actually what people do.
Okay.
What then words mean. So like, yeah. I get like a director. A director is like a composer. They direct everything. But I don't actually understand what a cinematographer does. And I don't understand why you would need a scriptwriter for a 3-minute long film. And I don't understand why you need a cinematographer for a 3-minute long film.
Yeah.
Or a producer. Yeah. I kind of assume that you would take on all those roles. Because I don't know anything. I'd be like, why would I want all those extra people?
Yeah, you can do it yourself. And carry on. Yeah, I know what you mean. I used to struggle with that. I sometimes do still struggle with why we've got Ned over there. Like, he's not doing anything.
Yeah.
But he's getting paid a lot of money just to stand there.
Yeah.
Which is fine. So cinematographer. Cinematographer is probably one of the most important roles in the whole process. They're essentially in charge of the cameras that you're going to shoot with and how everything's lit.
I'm glad you said that, because that's the thing I realised, that why your film looks cinematic is because the way it's lit. And it's the one thing that you can't tell what the cinematographer's done.
Yeah.
I can't tell. You can probably tell.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously you're there. Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like, I can tell a shot and when you've cut. And the noise.
Yeah.
I get all that. I can hear it and see it.
Yeah, yeah.
But a cinematographer, it says like a feel.
It's, yeah,
or
it
a
is.
Mood.
It's,
and you're like, oh, I don't know what he's done, but it looks amazing.
It's crazy how a good cinematographer can kind of, you know, someone could shoot that same shot or that same scene without, the shot design and the storyboarding was myself, and then went through it with Tom, my DOP.
Director of photography.
Director of photography.
Tom. Oh, yeah, I know my stuff. Don't know what he does. Yeah. Another one I want to talk about. We'll start with cinematographer.
Yeah. And one cinematographer could shoot that and it could end that same scene and it could look absolutely pants. And another one can come over to it and go, right, what's going on? And try and understand why we would shoot stuff in a certain way. There's a few shots where there's a lot of negative space in the shot, so you've got the guy's head in the bottom corner of the frame as opposed to having it more in the main side of the frame, and doing things like that, you know, you're showing more of the background and what's going on, and giving sort of this nicer element to what the guy's talking about, some serious stuff, at the same time he's being ignored by the doctor, so having that kind of disconnects our guy slightly from what's going on.
That's interesting, because just hearing you talk about negative space, it's not do kind of the same in architecture, but it's not something I would have ever thought while watching a film. I obviously subconsciously think it. And when I was saying, you know, I wanted to like do my little short film, whatever, I was obviously thinking of shots.
Yeah.
But I'm only I know they'd be cool, but that's because I've seen them in other films. Yeah. It's cool. I'm just replicating things that I've loved in other films.
Yeah.
I don't understand why.
Why people would use those shots.
Like, why is a tracking shot more important than a panning shot or a facial? Like, I know they... It would have all... To anyone who doesn't understand film, it would look like a film. But anyone to understand film would be like, he's doing every... Why has he done that to
I think
shot?
As well, if someone shot it badly, for someone who doesn't work in film, you would see it and go, oh, you'd feel uncomfortable. Mm. I think being successful at doing this is understanding what is pleasant for the audience and engages with the audience. And there's certain things that we like that people try and do that gives off certain reactions and feelings and everything. And you kind of learn what those are.
Yeah.
And then you start using it. And then you've got like this in the back of your head, this back catalogue of like, okay, we're going to do it like we're going to do a tracking shot along here now because it does this and this. Whereas someone else might just put the camera down and just film it plain and there's no movement in it. And so it's boring to watch. Which is what I've been trying to learn over the sort of 10 years of doing everything anyway, is watching why people do things and people's reactions to things over just going, well, I know the camera works. We're working with cameras for ages. So I'm just going to shoot anything. Like that's great learning all that stuff. And, you know, it's part of my day-to-day job, but what I'm more fascinated with is almost like the psychology of why when you watch something and it's shot in a certain way, you're more engaged with it than if someone shot it and they didn't shoot it in that way.
Mm. So, can I ask a technical question?
Yeah.
Move the microphone forward. You did a kind of a short film or a trailer. I couldn't work out. It was the beginning of a film. Anyway, it's about a hit woman.
Yes. So that was with this company Blockstop who, so they do like an interactive theater. So it's like a play. It's a play where basically one of the audience members will be in control, pretty much of the main actress. It's kind of like a theatre cross with a computer game.
Oh, wicked!
It's really cool. So they're basically upping their game and doing really well at the moment, and they wanted to. Have a film at the start of their play that kind of set the tone and set the scene of what was going on. So we had the actors from the play came over, they gave us a script, kind of worked through it all together. And then just, they were after like a sort of Nordic noir kind of feel to it because that's what it
was. What was the film called again? It was...
So that was called By the End of Us.
By the End of Us.
Was the name of the play. Yeah. And so this film was then shot and played the first 4 minutes was like played when the audience got there. So it was kind of like you start watching a film and then it becomes real life and you're in the play.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really cool because I kind of love the idea that like when I've gone to some plays before, I've seen bits of film projected in the background and I've always kind of thought, oh, it'd be nicer if we can integrate film and theatre a bit more. And I understand why people do it separately, but it was nice kind of...
Sorry, I've got a bit of gas.
bit of shandy. It was cool seeing...
The technical question I want to ask was, I was watching them going, well, how's he done that?
Yeah.
And in that, there's a few static shots of the cameras ever so slowly moving up and down. And I was wondering, is that you actually stood there or was that a static tripod one and you've put like a very subtle effect on to make it look like it's...
Yeah.
Because it feels more kinetic because the camera's moving.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be a tense scene, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I was thinking... Because I guess suddenly I was watching it like thinking, well, how have they done that? They've got her walking, handing the key, right? Yeah. They've got the shot and they're putting the earphone in.
Yeah.
And those shots, because they were like, I wasn't sure if you'd got actual handheld footage and do that time warp thing in Premiere Pro, which smooths it, or you'd actually just put a movement filter on it to make it look like it's moving.
The first one, yeah. So we shot the whole thing handheld. Primarily it was for the effect that it would give. And secondly...
Going for like
timing.
A Bourne identity.
Yeah, kind of Bourne, but without being throwing up Bourne.
Yeah.
You know, when you're watching, you go, I can't handle this.
Yeah.
So we shot it all handheld. And then in post, we just stabilized it a lot more than you would. I think we shot it at 4K resolution and it was only projecting at 2K or 1080p. So then that means you can come right in on the picture, which is good. So then we could stabilize everything nicely. And
can I ask you a nerdy question?
Different.
Because I've Okay, this is an aside, and we will come back to you again. I have a film director here, and I can finally ask you technical questions. And for all the listeners who know, who want to know. So, I love the GoPro cameras, and they're the terrible quality in comparison to a £100,000 film camera.
What's the lenses on them, though?
Yeah.
They're really wide.
Yeah, but for filming action sequences, I love. But I guess my question was, 1080p is basically what our TVs are in currently.
HD.
HD, unless you've got a 4K thingy, and then you're too rich and you have too much money because there's no content for it.
But then you'll always, if you're watching like standard broadcast TV on your 4K TV, it's always going to be 1080 at the moment.
Yeah.
Because it gets down compressed by the TV channels and then pumped back out. So unless you're watching a 4K DVD or 4K Blu-ray, you're not going to, like, my thing with 4K TVs at the moment is that
unless you're watching time-lapse footage, which is 4K and perfect.
Unless you're John Lewis watching your TV.
like, or you put a memory stick in, you're literally feeding. Oh, you're saying literally the TV channels don't have the capacity.
They broadcast 1080. So I don't know whether or not there's like some things where they
Netflix
might
does, but you have to pay more for it.
Yeah, probably, because they like doing that.
And you need like a hose pipe size optical cable fed into your house. Yeah,
exactly.
But sorry, so here's my question. Here's my question, Will.
sorry.
That's my question. Is it better to film in 4K and then shrink it down to 1080p? Or is it just the same to do it in just 1080p?
Depends why.
Let's say I'm leaping into a swimming pool and I want it to look crystal clear, every droplet of water to come out.
I would say, so, I mean, if you're filming with a GoPro, I'd probably put it at 4K. I think they can do 25 frames now, can't they? It used to be like 12 frames a second at 4K.
Well, here's my next thing. So you either get the Hero 4 Black, which does 4K at 30 frames a second, but doesn't have a viewfinder on the back.
Oh, no, I had to buy one for my one, which is very annoying. Yeah, yeah.
But the silver
does
come with it, but you can't film 30 frames a second at 4K. You can only film 2 and 2.7K.
Decided to get rid of that to put the thing on the back.
Yeah, yeah. There's some sort of bandwidth thing for the memory cards. So I was like, I don't care about that. I'm not I'm not going to film films in it. I just want it for fun on holiday.
Yeah,
and
also,
unless I've got terabytes of hard disk space, I'm going to munch through all of that.
I'd say 1080 then.
Yeah, so it's fine, stuff. Is it?
Yeah. Unless you're going to... I mean, I think even most...
I do have aspirations to film more. This is the thing.
Yeah. But I think even a lot of films are only kind of... I think they're projected at like 2K and 3.2K at the moment.
So 2.7K at 30 frames a second, scaled down to 1080p, is still amazing.
Is that better? Yeah. And at least then, I guess, it depends if you're... So it depends if you're like scaling in on the shot to down to 1080, or if you're just compressing down to the shot. Like they're kind of...
Oh, another different. Technical question. Yeah. No, I'm good. This is good. This, if people are listening, so maybe this is... Maybe
if you,
this is...
Yeah, if you shot it at 2.7K, you've... So, I mean, it's not... Between 2 and 1080, there's not a biggest difference.
Really?
Yeah, it's not... It's not like it's doubled. It's only...
Because part of me
I've
was thinking...
I've got a picture somewhere. I'll show you. It's like frame lines. It's really
cool. So I loved... Once I get something in my head that I want to buy it, I do endless research. Yeah. It drives my wife absolutely mental.
Yeah.
Are you going to buy... Are you paying for something? No?
Yeah.
No? So I've told her the GoPro is like 100 quid. Is it 100 quid? I'm like... Yeah,
it's not.
It's significantly more expensive than that. We have a baby now.
Yeah. But you want baby GoPro cam.
Yeah.
You just stick it on his head and just like...
And then I saw you can get a handheld gimbal for it. And I was like...
Yeah.
She was like, how much is that? I'm like, it's like 30 quid.
Yeah.
They're from China. They're like 150 quid. Anyway, so... But is it better to film at 1080p at 60 frames a second or 1080p at 30 frames a second?
Depends. Like, it depends.
This is all
action-y
stuff. It's all like being on holiday.
Well, I guess... Say you're like jumping into a pool.
Yeah.
And you wanted a nice slow motion shot.
Yeah.
Then you'd go a higher frame rate.
Yeah.
It depends what you're editing as well. So over here, we traditionally would edit at 25 frames. And like 25 frames is our base rate. In America, it's 24 frames. So you're then kind of having to divide whatever you're shooting at by 25. Yeah. So it would be better to shoot at 75 frames than 60 because it's easier to kind of do. So if you did want slow motion, shoot at a higher frame rate.
Okay.
If you just want someone jumping in the pool. Annoyingly, that is annoying if it shoots at 30 instead of 25 frames, because you've then got to bring it back down to 25.
It may do 25.
It might do 25.
So I'm going on holiday, so I need a cinematographer. I need a director of photography.
Yeah.
I can write the script myself. It's just jump in a pool.
You need a gaffer.
Yeah. What does the cinematographer do?
So cinematographer, pretty much the head of lighting department and the camera department.
Lighting.
And they will... It's like if you imagine the director's the architect,
yeah,
and the cinematographer's the engineer.
Okay,
so the architect goes,
Hey. Cracking metaphor.
Yeah, yeah.
I told this Chris once. He was very impressed.
He was like, oh, I get it now. Yeah, duh.
Yeah, yeah.
We're movies now. We're architects.
I once, a friend of ours at college went off to be an engineer, and there was, and this was brilliant. I love putting Chris in these scenarios and winding him up. And there was some building where, like the design, someone was chatting about how that each floor would rotate individually.
Yeah.
And so everyone could have their own 360 view whenever they wanted.
Utterly ridiculous.
Yeah. And, well, yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
And Chris was like, yeah, it's amazing. It's really cool. And our friend Mark from college was like, yeah, but come on. Like, as an engineer, he was like, this is stupid. How are you going to get from one floor to the next without getting your legs chopped off as you're going through the stairs or something? And so I just went, Chris, Mark, engage. And they just went at each other. And I was like, this is brilliant. Like,
it's so stupid, but it's amazing. Stupid, they're pushing the boundaries. And it's like,
oh, it's so beautiful. And I was like, yeah, I can see. Like, and I think that's the constant fight between directors and cinematographers as well, is, well, in some cases. And I kind of feel that maybe I'm slightly more relaxed than that because I've come from the camera background. I obviously understand what we can achieve.
Yeah.
And I'll try and push it a little bit if I can. But I won't ask for a rotating house where every floor rotates because I know logistically people are going to get their legs chopped off as they go between floors.
Which is bad.
Yeah, maybe. Bad. Insurance thing, maybe.
Insurance, got it. Because we have a running joke with the guy who does the renders here called Zach, that I come over and go, can you make it a bit lighter and a bit darker? And he's like, fucking every time.
Yeah.
Just, no. Just the cinematographer's like, look, you can't cheat light. And you're like, can you just make it lighter kind there of, and darker in the background.
I was I was on a Green Flag commercial last year, and it was all it was
is that the insurance company
the roadside they pull you over and stuff. And I was a camera assistant on that shoot, and I was with my friend Matt, who was the focus puller, and a guy Sam, who was the DOP. And we it was kind of one of the shoots where it didn't seem like enough stuff had been prepped. It was all kind of against us. And we came to the last scene, and this van's supposed to pull up, and these guys are dressed in like cheerleader outfits. They're going off to a stag do. And
oh, men.
Yeah.
Oh, damn it.
And
come on, Will. Yeah. Could have worked in the script a bit.
But so basically we'd been shooting all day. We'd kind of like worked through lunch. We were losing the light, and Sam, the DOP, rightly said, like, we need to crack on because we need to shoot the scene, and we're losing sunlight. And once we've lost it, this becomes a night scene. And I remember it was I think it was the director, or it was someone maybe at the advertising agency, just said, can you not just pull out like one of your lights? And it was like, what, to replicate the sun?
Yes, my like, sunlight.
I mean, there are lights that do that,
yeah,
but not when you're kind of traveling around motorways filming stuff. You're not going to be carrying one of those around with you. So I always remember that, just being like, you guys are in charge. And you've so asked
the,
for like
so the cinematographer doesn't have a sunlight, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Just, I mean, a torch.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a lot of jokes how cinematographers think they're gods.
Yeah. How do you know you didn't want to be a cinematographer?
I did for a bit, but then I think it was the kind of, so the cinematographer, you're in charge a lot with how the shots are done. You can ultimately say like whether or not a shot's going to work or not, because you would know technically how it's going to happen, and you could be like the stopper to that shot happening.
Cinematographer sounds more like an assistant director than it is what I imagined.
Yeah, yeah.
You are an assistant to the director. Your role is the light, the half of the scene, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. I think they're on par with the directors as well. I know a lot kind of directors will be like, I am the director. But I think they are on par with it because they're creating what the director wants. And I think they're equally as important with it.
Because I know Christopher Nolan like clings on to his director of photography.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I lost my... Where are we?
Cinematographer. So I'm at a swimming pool. I've got my cinematographer.
Yeah. So you got a cinematographer. Then you'd need... Then I would say...
What do I mean, director of photography? What's he doing here?
So he's going to be like, right... Well, the director would be like, okay, here's the action. Ben's going to walk over to the pool from the right side, go on the diving board and jump off.
Okay,
the cinematographer would be like, right, so what do we need to capture from this? And it's like, well, we need his face reactions and we need the jump and stuff. And it's like, okay, well, it'll be a few cameras then to get, because you're going to do this jump.
So the director literally, that's a really good example then. So I'm going to dive off a diving board.
Yeah.
I'm going to do a crazy high five move in the air. So the director goes, this is the scene.
Yeah.
He's going to dive in.
Yeah.
And I want... He's scared but happy.
Yeah.
And the cinematographer goes, right, you're going to need a zoom in on his face.
Exactly. You're going to probably need a camera on the face, because if you're jumping off the board and doing a high five or a silly move, I guarantee you won't be able to replicate that again.
Yeah.
So you then need to be able to shoot it from a wide shot to get like a big wider size of it.
Multiple.
So you'd have like a few cameras.
And the cinematographer's working this out, not the director.
Well, the director,
I want the feet going along the diving board.
Yeah, it's kind of a conversation between the two. The director will mainly say what he wants. I mean,
I did not know this.
Yeah, because I started off in camera. I kind of, when I'm thinking of these things, I'm thinking more along the lines of, okay, well, I want like a 24mm shot on the guy's feet over there, roughly, and then we'll have like 75mm on your face from that side. So I'm slightly more technical, maybe, than some. You get some directors who are really technical, some directors who aren't technical at all, but are then fantastic with their actors, and fantastic in other ways. So yeah, then the cinematographer will work it all out. And then on top of that, you need to light the scene. So that's when your gaffer comes in. Your gaffer's your head of the lighting department.
I thought cinematography was the lighting.
Well, he's in charge of, like, so the gaffer is like...
Okay,
so here's a whole new department that's going to come out.
Shut the front door. I had no idea all this existed. Okay, so the director... So you could have a scene where the director's actually chatting really intently with the actors.
Yeah.
Me, diving off the diving board.
Yeah.
He's like, Ben, I really want you to emote this.
Yeah, yeah.
And the cinematographer's actually working out where the camera and what shots
are. The camera's going, where the lights are then going. He's talking that through with the gaffer, and the gaffer then goes off and with his guys, they'll go and set up all the lights.
So the cinematographer goes, right, we want this amazing sunset. So the sun setting in the background jumps. And then the gaffer goes, okay, who decides what time of day to shoot if you're going to try and achieve that? Or do you all have a conversation?
That probably would have happened before you got on set day. So maybe in the script writing process, it would have said like sunset, Ben jumps off diving board.
Great scene.
Exterior, Ben jumps off diving board. Splash.
So a gaffer's in charge of all the lighting equipment then.
Yeah.
Right.
And then below him is the best boy. So that's like his second in command. And then you've got all your sparks or lighting technicians, but they're nicknamed sparks.
And the director of photography, what's he doing?
So he is in charge. He's kind of in charge of the lighting department. I mean, the gaffer's like the head one of the lighting department, but he's then in charge of them. The gaffer's like, they're always like best mates.
Mm.
All right, guys, that's good. Yeah, you want a light over there? Yeah, nice. Yeah, I'll just put that 12K out for you. It'll be lovely. Yeah. Do you want it on the left? Yeah, nice. It's in the talk. Yeah, that'd be lovely. And
it's kind of as clear cut as that. They're like the wide boys in the gaffer department, and the cinematographers are very artsy. And
well, yeah, sometimes.
Can like, we do it in black and white? No.
No. And then you've got your riggers as well with the lighting department, which is kind of like it's not quite lighting department, but they'll build like your scaffolding that the sets get built onto, but also the lighting rigs will get built onto that, and the camera rigs get built onto. So they're like their own separate department. They're kind of like a world of their own. So then you've got a sound department. So we're going to record the sound of your splash.
Yeah. Foley artist, I know that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's more post production.
Right.
On set, you'd have your sound recordist.
Yeah.
Then you'd have a boom operator and probably a sound assistant as well, and maybe even a sound trainee. The boom operator will probably be standing with his boom on his long boom pole. With it out of shot, if it's lots of multiple cameras, it's quite hard.
Does he get in trouble if it's in shot then? Is it like a running gag?
A lot. They always constantly.
It's in the shot again! God damn it!
The camera operator will be on the camera, just like sitting there.
Like a shifty sniper.
Yeah,
isn't
it is.
Like,
they are. They're like bloody snipers, and they're sitting there. And then we suddenly hear like, boom in shot. Boom in shot. And you're just like, oh, quick, get out. They just get such a hard rap the whole time. Because, I mean, I remember doing it once on a corporate shoot, holding the boom for like 2 minutes during the take. And I was like, that's a long time to keep your arms in the air holding that. And I never want to do that again. So I've like all due credit to people who hold a boom stick for that long.
It's just ripped ninja-like guys, aren't they?
Sometimes they're not. And you're I go to the gym a little
fag
bit.
Fag hanging out of their mouth.
Yeah, it can be. Like they're really, but they're just, I don't know what it is. I think there's something genetically built into them where their arms can just lock in that position.
Yeah. They're just quiet, silent people. Yeah. Just,
but they kind of. But also having to know, you've got to keep the boom, roughly above the actor while they're doing the lines and everything, and out of shot at the same time. And the closer you can keep the, like, if I'm right here, like, stand the microphone, lovely. It probably sounds better. Whereas
so
if I'm all the way back here,
is
you're getting in the atmosphere and everything that's going around. So you want to be this close, but at the same time, the edge of the frame might be literally between me and the microphone right now.
Yeah,
and if that comes in, you've ruined the shot.
Well, one of the things I was really impressed with yours is like the sound quality is amazing.
oh, it was good, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, really yeah. good. Like, as in this quality good.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, I don't understand how you can get the mic above and get quality that good. You didn't do any ADR.
No.
God damn, I love those extras, yeah.
But, so Joe Harris, fantastic sound recordist, came on.
Joe Harris.
Joe Harris. Right, mate, you're right. I'm Joe Harris. No, he's lovely. So we had radio mics on the actors, which are then kind of just placed underneath the clothing. Okay. That's an art form in itself. I've tried to do that before and just got in trouble. Yeah. Like how someone gets it on without like going on with the rustling of the shirts. It's brilliant what they do. And then at the same time, he was he was sound recording and boom operating at the same time, which is a bit bonkers, but like doable. So that's what, and then especially for Brian, our main actor in that, he had such gravitas to his voice, so deep, and like, you know, sent him off for a cigarette before he started the scene to make it even deeper. he did a fantastic job on that. So yeah, then you've got your sound guys normally on the shoot, so we're gonna get a recording of you saying some stupid line before you go off the diving board, oh, I love you, mum,
yeah,
and then you're gonna jump off, and then we need to get the recording of the splash as well, but the boom operators have got to get that sound without getting in. Say we've got five cameras getting these shots,
yeah,
and they're all at different angles, and the cameras aren't in each other's shots, so that's well choreographed by the cinematographer. The boom operator's now got to do the same thing, but get as close to you as possible without fucking up the shots.
Yeah.
And then what else? So we've had to build the diving board that wasn't there.
Okay.
So we've had a production designer come in and design the sets.
Yeah. Can it be a knob-shaped diving board?
Pretty much,
Good, good, okay, good.
With like Ben written in the top of the little spurty bit. No, but the ball's at the bottom. And the diving board's coming out the top end.
Oscar-worthy, this is.
Yeah, so production designers designed that, and then they've got an art director who will be on set. There'll be a set designer and a set dresser and set builder, construction team. That's like a building site lot. They're incredible.
Latest film, how much of this stuff did you have? You had a cinematographer.
Yeah, I had a cinematographer, had a sound recorder. We didn't have production design because I think there was... We were going to have someone and then we didn't. And then it was kind of coming last minute. And it was quite simple production design anyway, not to kind of take away the value of what they do.
You had a gorgeous house to film.
We had a gorgeous house to film. And like some of the sets were really basic.
Yeah.
And I made it purposely basic because I wanted to concentrate on more what was going on in the action. Then we had Hugh, who was the gaffer, who was fantastic and can literally create feelings and shapes out of lights. He's brilliant. Him and Tom, the cinematographer, together, like, did a fantastic job making that all happen. What else did we have? So then we had all that. Oh, my friend Natalie was a costume designer. So brought out some fantastic costumes. When we first met up as well, one of my big key things I like doing is having lots of colour in things.
Mm.
And I like to kind of set each character as a certain colour in a way, or a certain like shade of colours.
Yeah.
So for the doctors, they're in shades of blue, nurses in blue, the old guys in green, in ice cream in the first film. Ice cream man's obviously in white, but I made him, everything was white. It wasn't like white t-shirt and jeans. Everything was white trousers, cowboy shoes. And the mum was all in pink, the boys in blue, just loads of bold colours. So Natalie, when she came on to do this, was really keen with that as well. And I thought did a fantastic job with that.
Who paid for all this?
Kind people through Indiegogo.
Hey, did you do it on Kickstarter?
Indiegogo.
Crowdfunding.
Crowdfunding website that should be unnamed.
Yeah.
Indiegogo, which I do prefer Indiegogo to Kickstarter in that if you don't hit your target, you get your money still, which is good.
Yeah.
Whereas I think still with Kickstarter, you have to reach the target, otherwise you don't get anything. And I think even if you've got your money behind you, you then gotta put it into the Kickstarter, and it's kind of like you feel like you've not raised as much.
Yeah.
Whereas Indiegogo, so I think in total we raised like 3.5-4 in total.
And how did you know who to market that? You didn't just put it on blindly. Did you specifically target certain sides, parts of Indiegogo?
It's kind of, the thing I found with Indiegogo and Kickstarter, it's like when you're doing a 10K run or a London Marathon. It's really hard to get people to get, like, especially nowadays, if you went and did a marathon like 10 years ago, people were like, yeah, here's some money. Yeah, you did a marathon. That's an incredible thing. everyone does a marathon nowadays.
Yeah. My friends are like, I'm not going to pay you to do something you want to do. I'm like, yeah. I'm not getting the money myself.
Yeah. It's going to this charity where people need it. Yeah. And like, and then when you try and do the same thing, and it's like, they're like, what are you fundraising for? I'm going to make a film. Oh, so it's not for a charity? No. Is it going to go towards a charity or something? No, I just want to make a film.
Yeah.
And give me your money, please. And loads of people just like, you know, wouldn't reply. So I find that Indiegogo and Kickstarter are great platforms to have everything there, but I don't think they're a source of getting the money. And I think a lot of people go onto them and think, oh, I'm going to start a Kickstarter and then I'll just get 10 grand in a couple of weeks and it'll be great.
So you literally just went on Indiegogo,
yeah,
made a trailer, I presume, or like you filmed yourself going, hi, I'm Will, I want to do a film.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you got 4 grand for it.
Mm.
I'm going to need to go on the Indiegogo site and see what you did for this. Did you dance a little bit? Or
we had I should have done a dance. I would have made more money, maybe.
I'm so impressed. This is amazing.
So the main doctor, Dannings, the lovely actor Dannings, came in, and the production company Upbeat that helped me with this, we filmed in their studios, and they'd written a little crowdfunding script where the doctor approaches everyone and says, look, we're trying to do these things with science, and
did like a film inside a film. That's quite cool.
And then we were kind of like, we're not asking for funding for the science of it, we've got all that sorted, we need funding for the recording of it in full HD in color with sound equipment and, you know, the best motion capturing technology around. And it was kind of that 1930s 40s sort of grainy 4x3 kind of screen thing going on, which was really cool
with the noise of the film stuff.
And it would just, and we shot it in like 2 shots, and it would just jump cut between things where, you know, maybe an editor would have rushed back then and fucked up the cuts. And, so that was really nice. But and it was good to have a video, and it was good. We slowly released bits of information, so we didn't release everything that was going on straight away, mainly because things weren't 100% confirmed as well. And you don't really want to be publicizing that, like, hey, we've got this person with us and we're filming at this place, and then it gets pulled away because you look stupid. So then the next bit was, you know, we put it out there, and we put out links on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all this malarkey, and we got a few things straight away, and then it just went dead. And it was like, ah, okay. And I was like, this isn't as easy as like, as
well,
you
that's
think.
What I'd imagine would happen, right?
You're like, because people don't go on Indiegogo and go, oh, I'm going to go on Indiegogo and see where I can put some money today.
Yeah. You
know? Like, that's never going to happen. So then it was, I ended up approaching about 600 people through Facebook. Individually, politely,
600 people.
It's like a lot of friends.
Oh, aren't you big deal? 600 people.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's kind of less now because people just left. Yeah.
Hey, Gary, I know we haven't seen each other since secondary school, but
this friend of mine, David, who I haven't seen since secondary school. I think I briefly saw him after college or something. But he messaged me going, and he'd been out drinking, and he'd come home and just open his Facebook and been like, oh, a message from Will, I haven't heard from him in ages. And he just wrote to me going, oh, so I got a message from you thinking, not heard from you ages, wondering what you're doing, catching up, and you're asking me for money, thanks. And I was like, yeah, sorry. And he went, oh, here's 25 quid. And I was like, oh, okay. And we were chatting for a bit, and he was obviously drinking a bit more, and I was coming home from a night out as well, so we just, you know, laughing around about things. And then he just went, oh, I'm going to give you another 25 quid because it's great to hear from you and all this kind of stuff. And then I got a message from him the next day going, can I get any of that money back? And I was like, I'm really sorry, but it's kind of gone through into the system, and like, but thanks. Like, you'll get a special thank you. Which he has.
Yeah.
He's now had a special thank you in the podcast, and and his name's at the end of the film in the special credits as well.
Okay.
Well done, David Honkish. But
good man. Drunkenly give you 50 quid.
I know. That is a good source of getting money. Go and chat to people when they're pissed.
Yeah.
And people get excited. People get excited about films anyway. And they're like, filmmaking's great and it's glamorous and la la la. Yeah. And if you're chatting to people sober, like, they do get a bit excited. But the moment you then go, yeah, we're making a film, do you want to? And they're like, it's fine. Like, we'll just watch it when it's made. It's like, well, it won't get made unless. So I remember going out a few times and just drinking with people and then bringing up the subject. And they
so you
just did
a
go
lot of drinking.
Yeah, a little drunk, you know, for the good cause.
So how long did it take you to raise your target then?
I think we did it. So we ran it for 30 days and we got, what did we get? So without the private, so some people didn't want to give us money through Indiegogo because Indiegogo takes a certain percentage of it. Mm. So they just gave us money on the side. So I think within like 30 days, we raised like $3,000 of it. Yeah, just over $3,000. Yeah, like 3,300 or something. And then the rest kind of trickled in at different points.
Wow.
Which was good.
So you spent the grand on the sheepskin fur coat you're wearing right now, and then the rest was just spent
on the
film.
The rest we kind of, well, I think I look really nice.
The diamond cane's a nice touch.
It's good.
But so I like...
Swatsky.
How do you... So you said you got friends involved. So but all the money was basically the insurance, the cameras, hiring the venue.
Yeah.
Sheepskin cane.
Not so much insurance, the cameras this time. So Tom had his own camera equipment, but has his own high-end cinematic equipment. So
who's Tom, the cinematographer?
Tom's the cinematographer. Tom. Lovely Tom.
The brains behind the operation.
Pretty much. Like, the saviour. So he had his own kit, which was great. So that kind of...
Not another £100,000 camera.
I don't think it's quite as much as that, but it's in the league.
What is he, a drug dealer?
He does pretty well.
How do you get, like...
So he works mainly as a... Have you seen the Steadicam rigs? Steady shots and like Ripley in Aliens, where you've got the gun attached to that thing. So there's these smaller rigs that have come out recently. One's called a Movi and one's called a Ronin, and he's got a few of those that he's invested in with friends, and then they go off and they do loads of shoots. And so I met him on shoots when he came on as a Movi operator with these small high end cinematic cameras, and we just got chatting, and I was like, "Do you wanna come and work and do a short film? That'd be really cool." The majority of the money then went into the National Trust's pocket because they like to charge short films the same amount of money as the big feature films and TV guys. There was no kind of...
I guess their argument is, well, you're stopping a major feature film from filming, so you're not that booked.
Exactly.
Come on.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, we were filming in rooms that weren't being used by the public, so... it's not like anyone was going to be using them anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that was a huge amount of our budget went into that, and costume as well, which I didn't realise how much went into costume until when we finished filming, and I was like, oh crap, that's a lot of money for...
In terms of costume and the costume design and stuff.
Yeah.
Were you like, I could save a lot of money if I just go to a antique store and just buy old stuff, or was that totally integral to
you
your...
You kind of could, but then in that same way that if you're doing stuff
I'm
like
not
that,
undermining it.
But in that same way, I think that's one of the things that I'm trying to hope makes things stand out, is that go to an antique shop or a charity shop to buy costumes, you might as well then be going off and shooting it on the 5D and having torches instead of lights getting your mates to act in it. You've kind of started you just started dropping the bar already. So you might as well try and keep everything up as high as possible. And you can see... There's always a lot of talk of production value and how much of that is seen on screen.
Yeah.
And so I just want to try and keep that production value up as high as possible with this one.
So your 9-minute film, as a team, what, five of you?
On the shoot day itself?
Yeah.
And then we had makeup, Liana, and a hairstylist, Helen. Who else did we have? My nephew, Luke, who is always my runner at the moment. Because he's doing his GCSE, so I just rove him in. I'm like, I need a runner.
Perfect.
And when he learns to drive, he can be a runner driver.
Yeah.
Which would be great. He would love it.
Yeah.
I hated that. But
you're now that guy. It's such a great experience, and you can understand the industry. Yeah. I hate being a runner.
Yeah.
Grow up.
Grow up, Luke. Get on with it. You don't know. Who else did we have? And then we had our producer, Zara. We then had Tom from Upbeat, who was doing behind the scenes photography, and Kieran, who was doing the sort of... They're called EPKs, which are electronic press kits, which is behind the scenes video.
Don't know what that means. What does that mean? Behind the scenes video.
So you know when you watch DVD of how they made Lord of the Rings?
Oh, you did a making of?
We had a making of going on at the same time.
I didn't know.
So there'd be video shots of me just sat there with a monitor in my hand going, I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah. I really want to go home.
Yeah.
I'm quite tired and I've not slept.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm being filmed. Hi. Action.
So I haven't watched that. I didn't know you did a making of.
Yeah, that's being made at the moment. Because they wanted for the film to be finished and then they can drop in here's Will chatting about a scene and here's the scene.
Yeah. That's amazing. Oh, I can't wait to watch that.
I'm quite looking forward to that. It'd be cool to see how much of a knobhead I look like on set telling people what to do.
You're just a real bastard on set. Hey!
Say your lines properly and just punch people in the face.
Just do it again. Do it again.
Yeah. Do it this time again. But without looking at me.
Yeah. Don't make eye contact with me. Open the door for me.
Nobody look at the director. He's in the room.
How many takes do you do? Because, it's the thing about your film and what I'm suddenly realizing is I haven't noticed the hair, the costume design, the makeup, yeah, which is a massive compliment.
Good.
Because it is a film.
Yeah.
Whereas if his hair was crap and his, like, he just looked knackered,
you'd pick up on it. And that's kind of what I'd love, is that if people watch it and don't notice any flaws, and then it means that we've done our job properly.
But like, how many times, like, because I some actors obviously will understand there's a process to acting, and you know, the first couple of takes you're getting warmed up, and the third one you're there. But are you like, you have a real clear image in your head of what you want?
Yeah.
Now it needs to be said like this.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not saying it's blunt.
No.
You know
no.
what I mean? How many takes of, like, did you do?
So Brian, our main actor, I had a rehearsal day with him the day before. So for a lot of it, the guy has, excuse me, guy does not have as many beers as the director did that day. Back in the golden days of the 80s, we used to drink on set. We had a rehearsal there, and during the film, he has a lot of sort of audio flashbacks. I didn't want to have to do visual flashbacks. Because I thought it was nicer. You hear what he hears in his head, but also we had to go and shoot some of the stuff that he hears.
You always forget that a dream sequence has to be filmed. It's not a dream.
Yeah.
It's like really complicated.
Yeah. And I'm quite interested in like sound engineering as well, and how you can hear things and how that triggers off memories, and you don't have to see things all the time, which is, I think, really cool. So we had a day of like listening to certain atmospheric noises and stuff during certain parts of the scene, and music when he remembers certain things. So we were pretty much between us prepped, and then we went off and shot everything else in the morning, got to the main scene in the afternoon. And the other thing I wanted to do with this was not be, so I know sometimes on a lot of shoots you'll run, like, you get your wide shot set up and you run the whole scene from that wide shot, and then you've got your master, you can cut into it here and there.
Annoying to have to do, like, knowing that this scene from a distance, you're not going to have a close-up camera. So
well, and the majority of it, you're not going to use majority of that shot because you're going to be in close-ups at that point. And I was just thinking for this, especially, I mean, we were time-constrained as well, so it kind of helped doing it this way. But I was thinking, right, for this paragraph that he's going to say, I want this shot. For the next paragraph, I want that shot. So I'd let him start from the previous paragraph, get into it, and then come out of it, and then we'd cut.
Yeah, nice.
And then we'd set up the camera for the next angle. So it was a bit bitty, but it kind of made it easier in a way for Brian to be, because they're like slightly different things that are going on, made it easier for him to transition between all of this. And I mean, one thing my editor said when we first got into it, Nick, was that there were some bits where we maybe could have done with a master shot to fix things up, but then when we got into the editing process, I was like, no, it's fine, because I don't want to see that angle on that. Like, I only want this shot on this paragraph. I only want this shot on his eyes when he's thinking about this, or this shot on his hands when he's thinking about this.
And did you do versions where he does it more intensity, or quieter, or softer, or angrier? You know, like
on the day, not really, because we'd had the rehearsal time.
Oh, yeah.
We kind of tweaked it. And it was good kind of having that. The main reason I wanted the rehearsal as well is because I knew we had like no time when we got to Ham House, and we kind of had to get there and just do it and nail it straight away. There'd be times where, you know, I might ask him to put more emphasis on one word, or not look in a certain direction, or, you know, little tiny things.
So that comes down to your relationship with him, right? Like, you've built up trust, and like, you're not being a dick.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah, don't look at me, Brian.
Yeah.
Like, when you're saying the lines, don't look me in the eye. And just having that great trust with him. And also, like, full credit to him, we'd met properly the day before. I mean, we met in the auditions, but we met properly the day before. And he
did auditions as well.
Yeah, we did auditions. Especially
your mate, Brian.
Yeah. Well, Brian was one of the first guys that I actually spoke to anyway over the phone when we were looking for people. And then we set up an auditions with some other people, and we saw their performances. And the other, I'm not going to say that bit about the casting because it will give away the twist. But but then Brian came in and his performance was like, fuck, this guy's really good.
Yeah.
Like, we've got to have him. And we can fix everything else around, you know, that's fine. Like, this guy is holding the film together. Let's bring him in. And then when we met properly for the rehearsal time, we went through everything. And then on the day, he'd obviously put a lot of trust in me that, like, he must have thought Will must know what he's doing, which is great, because I don't think I did.
What a fool!
Exactly. But then just went in the direction that I wanted to send his character in, and did it fantastically. Even his little tiny nuances and things that he was doing were along that line.
Were there things on the day that you were like, oh, that's good? I wasn't expecting him to do that. Or was it very, like he was... Yeah. Because I don't know what the... Like,
no, definitely.
It must be like... you've got a very kind of very pure relationship that like... The trust, like you're literally pointing a camera and this guy's got to act and exactly what you want.
Yeah.
It's one thing to think it, but to actually be there on the day,
you'd be like... And I think you always have ideas in your... You always have ideas in your head of how something's going to look and how it's going to be, and it's never going to be that. And when you get there on the day, you know, like something's going to happen that's going to put it slightly off or make it slightly better. Mm. And yeah, watching Brian, like when we were doing it, he was just kind of like, it was just like 110% the whole way through. And I was like, this is really good.
Yeah.
It's really good. We can crack on with the next shot really quickly now. And we maybe did like 2 or 3 takes on each shot. Sometimes just like 2 takes. Because I quite like, if we've done it,
yeah,
I want to get on with it. Like, I want to get on with the next shot. I feel confident we've got it. And as long as, you know, there hasn't been any issues with the camera or the sound or lighting, and there's not been anything like someone walking through shot or because the public were there as well at Ham House at the time, kids were starting to scream at that point. So checking with Joe and sound that, like, you know, you can't hear the kids screaming. Like, you want a bit of atmosphere going on that it's not a dead, dead place that you're in. But you don't want, like, some 5-year-old just screaming their head off and crying because they haven't had an ice cream. Or gone and watched my film Ice Cream. That's what they're more upset about. But
because what was I going to say? It's amazing just to think that there's that many things going on, and I wasn't aware of like 3/4 of them.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
Because I was wondering as well, like you know, you said you need a sound recorder, and back to our swimming pool scene.
Yeah,
like would you record the splash going on, or would you just buy a splash noise, which is probably way better quality? Or is there a continuous that might be way better quality than the rest of your recording? So actually, the consistency, like I've not really thought about the sound as a separate
entity. Yeah. I think you'd always try and capture it on the day, and then you've at least, if it's not a great, like the quality wise might be really good, but if the sound isn't quite maybe impacting enough or anything, at least then you've got it as a guide track to kind of, for the editor to kind of match up. And then you might go down the route of Foley artists who will go and grab a giant melon and throw it into a paddling pool at home and record that sound, and that gives an amazing effect somehow.
I love it.
Like, it's like bonkers how they kind of, you know, like the coconut shells making horse feet running down the road. You're like, how someone worked out that that was a perfect sound on camera.
I think because you're basically explaining why I love doing this podcast is that... there's so many things I wasn't even aware of. So you've kind of opened my eyes to so many things. And I love films. So like, you know, things like in Star Wars, the way they like ping electricity cables to get those noises, or like the Matrix punches, like they recorded like almost all of them individually. And, and you're like, it's nice to see that it is as much effort as you think it would.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I love, is then when people are trying to up their game with it, and you know, say like someone's punching something, like with the Matrix, and you've got different punches going on. Maybe they've just gone to like a meat factory and they're just punching different animals and different
Rocky
ones.
Style.
Yeah, Rocky style. But like different animals give off different sounds, and hitting them in different places would give off different sounds as well. And you think, right, well, he's just punching him in the face there, so that's a slap to a chicken.
Yeah.
And he punches him in the gut there, it's definitely a punch in the pig, you know.
Yeah.
But knowing that those little, you know, and then when you watch it back as someone who hasn't known that process has happened, and you're convinced that those are the real sounds, that's brilliant. When you when you have no idea of how it's all come together.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah. I remember, you know, talking about Lord of the Rings in the, I can't remember which one it is, but there's a massive spider that gets Frodo and like wraps him up.
Oh, like the third one or something.
Yeah. And it's like wrapping him up. And but it's this horrible, slimy noise. And then watching them do it, and they've got like toilet plungers going... into a bowl of water or whatever.
Yeah.
And you're like, it's so basic, but at the same time, amazing.
But and then they'll know that that's how you get that sound as well. That's that's the skill in it, is not just being able to do that, but then knowing, have the knowledge and the experience behind you to be able to pull it off. And
then I guess sometimes seeing that, again, I don't know why Lord of the Rings, just the makings of so good, but in the last one, they're firing these massive rocks.
Yeah.
And they're trying to make the noise, and Peter Jackson's like, well, do you know what the sound of a massive rock? So they just went to a quarry and drop a 10-ton rock onto a load of wood.
Wow.
And that's the noise.
There's
and I was
noise.
Like, that's like boys playing stuff though, isn't it?
It is. I think that's one of the really exciting things with this, is that you are, when you get down into those sort of aspects of it, you're basically playing with big boy toys a lot of the time.
Playing with a 100-grand camera, you're like, this is the closest I'm going to get to a bazooka.
Yeah.
Really, isn't it? This is like my electronic version of a bazooka.
It's fantastic. And you kind of, the buzz that you get off that sometimes is brilliant.
Especially that you're organising it. This is like, you're the orchestrator of this. You're like, that's what I was going to ask you. One of the things I struggle with personally is like just retaining confidence and momentum in a project. Yeah, yeah. I tend to have wild enthusiasm, yeah. probably coupled with coffee.
Yeah.
I think about it loads. Mm-hmm. I love it. It's the best idea ever.
Yeah.
And I start it. It's total shite.
Yeah.
And then I go down. I lose all confidence in it. I stop and move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
I have a habit of doing that.
Yeah.
The podcast is one of the few things that I've, because if it's like, I just talk.
Yeah.
I can do that. That's easy. And I can do it every couple of, sometimes I don't feel, do them for a month because I've stacked three back to back. But how, like with a film project, it's quite intense, I would imagine.
Yeah. So like, it's a similar thing, I think, with like your, with the podcast with you, in that, like, I've got so many ideas in my head and I'm just like, oh, I should go, we should do this. And like, oh, we should do a comic book, which would be like the lead up to how the film starts. And then we'll sell like, we'll have like the action figures and people go and play with the action figures. And then they won't know why they're playing with them, but that's part of the film as well. Yeah. And I think the key to it all of like keeping it all go. Well, I think the key to it all is like keeping it all going and just keeping all those ideas. Yeah. Just let them happen. And when people are just like, oh, shut up, you're always coming up with ideas and you never follow them through. It's like, because there's so many, I can't follow them all through. But like, just keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going. And I think the other thing is probably get married.
Yeah.
Because they just tell you to shut up.
Yeah. I was about to say, it's, I was, do you know what, it's funny you say that because I'm actually just thinking of my wife going, why?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, why would you do that?
Yeah.
And it's her face. And I'm like, just piss on my parade, won't it?
Yeah,
like,
no, it is.
But you're right.
Hugely. But in the best way possible.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you kind of need someone who can be that close to you to, you know, to annoy you that they didn't quite like this or that. Or that you're, you know, my wife's always saying, you know, you're always chatting about things, you never get on and do it. Like, I was chatting about I want to go to the gym more and I just don't and I won't. But like, if I keep chatting about it, at least there's a potential that I will go maybe three times a week instead of once a month. But
I don't know what your wife's like, but I actually take a compliment from my wife way higher than anyone because she's incapable of lying to me.
Yeah.
She'll just go, yeah, it's okay. But when she goes, that's really good, I'm like, yes, it must be really good.
Yeah, when... I always like to kind of use her as like one of my first critics and try and not let her see anything until it's happened.
Yeah.
And it's really hard because I'm like, oh, this is like, we just done this edit. It's really cool. And I know she'll come over and watch it and be like, well, that needs fixing, that needs fixing, that needs fixing. I'm like, yeah, but that's edit two.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is edit one. Like, just shut up and watch it. So I try and keep her out of it as much as possible until towards the end. Ice Cream, I remember she liked, but she wasn't massively over enthused about it. And I was like, oh, that was my first short film.
God damn you, woman.
Yeah, I was like, can you like it a bit more? But, and then when we made the film for Blockstop, she was like, fuck, that's really good. And I was like, what? Whoa, what was that?
Yeah.
You said that was really good. That's nice.
I heard you. I've got it now.
I got it in my head that you said that. And then Somatic, I know that she said she really liked that as well. I think with Somatic, though, I kind of... It was a lot longer project than before, so she's probably about a bit fed up with it. But we recently watched it, myself and her and two friends, when we were on holiday together. They wanted to have a preview of it, and they had a smart TV, so we put it on and they watched it. And I kind of sat there not watching it because I'd seen it so many times, and just watched the rest of them. And she was like, "Yeah, it's really good. Well done." And I was like, "Yeah, that's a compliment there. Yes, that's really."
Well, we are rapidly coming to the 2-hour mark,
so
I will wrap this up.
Yeah.
But one of the another thing that I get shy of, and now I wanted to ask you about, is that I don't actually like people. I don't like watching people listen to what I've done. If they come up to me afterwards and say, "Oh, I listened to your podcast," oh, brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
But if I know that they're listening to it on the computers, I hate that. So, like, did you hire a screen, how did you show off your video? Or did you get everyone in a room like, guys, I finished the film, come and watch?
Somatic, because we're about to go like start doing festivals and stuff. We're trying to organise a screening for the cast and crew at the moment, which would be amazing if we can get that sorted out. Because I'd much rather have everyone together watch it for the first time than like with Ice Cream, we just sent everyone the link and they could all watch it at home. So yeah, that'd be much better. But I remember when we did Blockstop, so we went to Southwick Playhouse to go and be part of the audience, myself and the editor, Nick, and a friend of ours, Aaron, who came along with us. And I just, instead of, because I'd seen that film, you know, as you do loads of times, I literally just sat in the audience just watching everyone watch it. And I was like, and I was saying to Nick, I was like, this is the weirdest thing. And he was like, yeah, I know. He was like, I've never watched people watch my stuff before either. And I was like, yeah, it's just really like, and no one was like, oh, God, boring, you know, which was good. No one was like OTT either, which was quite good. Everyone was just kind of smiling and happy and enjoying it and like, you know, watching it. And I was like, this is so weird. Like, no one knows that we're here. And those two names that just popped up on the screen, like in the credits, they're ours. Yeah. They don't know that link between us and them. And we're just like immersed in this audience watching people's reactions. Which is the weirdest feeling.
Was it good thing?
Really, like, good feeling.
But did you not hate it? You're like, oh, that person over there. If there was 100 people in the room and two of them didn't like it, I would just concentrate on those two and be like,
I think so,
I'm terrible at that.
Yeah, no, like, I am. Like, my own, I moan too much about stuff. And I think I probably would be like, yeah, well, Jeff and Dan didn't like it, so I'm going to fuck off.
Yeah, but like, fuck you, Jeff.
Yeah, well, Jeff wore a stupid tie, so that's why he doesn't like stuff. And like, Dan hasn't even got shoes on. But yeah, I'd like to do that a bit more. In the, like, initially when we went in the Playhouse to go and watch it, I was really nervous because I was like, oh my God, we're going to be surrounded by people who are going to watch our film. And the moment it started, that feeling just went away. And I'd spent the whole time just watching everyone.
Yeah.
And I was just fascinated by the reactions. And I thought, this is like having like a focus group watch your film for the first time, like, and trying to pick up on what they did and didn't like. And I'd love to do that a bit more, just like watch people watch stuff, but people that I don't know. When your friends and family watching stuff, it's like the thing when you've got like you do a GCSE project and you show it to your family for the first time, they're like, yeah, it's really nice. You just get really embarrassed and shy.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Oh, it's nice, but yeah, shut up. But I'd love to watch like just a normal audience watch Somatic and just see what they actually think.
How many, for editing, basically, what I was going to say is, so I listened, as a throwaway comment, my dad listened to this podcast and went, it's great, but you don't actually talk about anything. And I was like, Dad, it's an hour long. He's but you're not, you don't, you know, there's no like, I'm like, there's no bullet points. Yeah, sure. Yeah. And it like, it was just such a, oh, Jesus, come on.
That's such a parent comment though, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, your film, did it, like, during an edit, does someone go, Joe, it's just not working? And you're like, because that must be the hardest comment to work against. I guess the advantage of a shorter film is that it naturally is super tight.
Yeah. That was that's hugely one of my worries, is if someone watches it and doesn't get it.
Yeah.
And you're like, fuck, we failed. Like, and because you've shot everything and you've invested so much time and people's money into like shooting this was a palaver in a good way, but it was a palaver and there was a huge amount involved. And if we had to go back and shoot a bit of it would just be out the, it would unfortunately be out the question. If it was like a bigger feature film or a TV program,
for like reshoots or something,
go for reshoots, so like send off a second unit, go and film it properly for us and we'll put it in the edit. And that was one of my biggest worries, was that people would watch it and not get it, and because you haven't got that reliance that you can go off and reshoot bits that don't work, it's a bit more stressful. One of my aunties watched it over the weekend and got back to me with her views on what she thought it was all about. And I kind of leave the end of it open-ended. Like, I don't tell you how something has happened. I just kind of, it's a bit arty and lovely and stuff. But she had her own, she was saying, well, what happens at the end? And I said, well, what do you think happens? And she told me. And I won't say what she thought because I don't want, like, you go and watch it and you'll see. But it wasn't what I thought, and I kind of left it. But I was like, she didn't say she didn't get it. She
you look like, it's not what fucking happens in the film, you thicko. No,
he flies home in a rocket ship. but it was...
Just hang up.
Yeah.
Fuck you.
Not coming around your house again. It was a stupid party.
Are you quite happy to hear people, but at least they've emotionally engaged with it, right?
Exactly.
Oh, do you know what?
Yeah, and it was really nice kind of hearing a different point of view on it. And because I'd purposely left it open-ended, I was like, I've not thought that. That's quite cool. Yeah. I mean, it's not in my mind what it is, but that doesn't mean that I'm right. I made it and directed it and wrote it and la, 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 but I'm not... Because I've left it open-ended, that means there isn't a right answer to it.
Yeah.
It's hugely wrong answers.
Yeah.
You really don't get it. Like, oh,
do you know what I think happened? That's wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, you're wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Shut up. Shut up. Go away.
Do you okay, I will... I keep saying I'm wrong. But I'm going to keep talking naturally. Mm. But one of the things that... do you watch South Park?
Yeah.
Hugely. So you know when Mr. Garrison writes a book, it's a romantic novel between a man and a woman.
Yeah.
He's like, it's actually, you mentioned the word cock in it like 5,000 times, the gayest novel ever.
Yeah.
And he gives away part of his personality he wasn't aware that he was giving away, right?
Yeah.
Like, do you ever think in your films that, like, you're a massive homosexual? that, you know, like maybe, I don't know, like if you're a hopeless romantic or something, yeah, and yeah. a lot of your films concentrate on
and then just every that. Film people watch, it's like that's really wet.
Yeah, yeah. You're like, oh, is that like? Do you feel you're giving away a bit of your personality, or you're like, no, I'm actively gonna not engage with something by doing something else? Because you, no matter how hard you try,
you're gonna inject yourself into it, aren't you?
Ignoring something and doing something else, or way over engaging in something.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah, that massively. I think that with Christopher Nolan, that he's like, not in a bad way, but I think he's got dad issues.
Yeah.
You watch his films, there's always a father figure thing going on. And I don't know whether or not, like, it's because he's
that
got...
that same guy. What's his name? Alfred.
Alfred. Alfred.
Yeah.
Michael Caine. And, yeah. So, and I was thinking with that, I was like, yeah, he's got these... you know, you watch a Christopher Nolan thing and there's always a father figure thing. In Interstellar, it's about the relationship between a father and a daughter. Batman, there's lost all those undertones of it. Lost his parents. even in The Prestige, it's about you know, you've got that element of Christian Bale's character trying to reach out to his daughter as well. Yeah, it's father and daughter, actually.
Actually, Inception's exactly the same. Is Cobb lost his wife and his kids or whatever?
Yeah, lost his wife and kids. Yeah, which I guess maybe it's something because it resonates with everyone because family's important to everyone.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I wonder if there is something where. You know, publicly, he's never spoken about something.
Yeah.
And he just wants to talk about it through his films. So, I don't know, maybe...
But I guess, like, because I was thinking...
That'll happen with me and...
The only reason I asked is just because I'd never, ever thought about actually doing a short film.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I saw yours and I was like, I'd love to try it. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think I'd be very good at it. I want to try it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I was looking at yours thinking, do you know what? Wow, now I realise what elevates it above a normal film is the, you know, all the work that goes in behind it.
Yeah.
But at the time, I was like, well, you've got great actors.
Yeah, yeah. Fantastic actors.
Great cameras, obviously. Great, nice. Everything looks really nice. And then the set was so nice.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, because this is what I was going to ask you. I mean, if the project that I'm going on goes ahead, on the previous project I was on, Broadgate, we built Skyscraper. But for ages, it was just like hanging steel right in the centre of London. And I was thinking... If you're going to film, I don't know, I was thinking of loads of different things, but something where you're up on high in the middle of London, there's that sense of like being in the middle of the heart of the city, but being totally lonely. It's that lovely contrast. And I was thinking, you know, if I had the opportunity, you know, to give someone the ability to film up there,
it
would be amazing because you'd have this £1 billion set, but it would be free type thing. And that, and the reason it got me thinking was I walk around Alexandra Palace in North London every day with my dog and baby. And I love it.
You put the baby on the dog like a donkey.
Naturally, I'm not a baby carrier.
I'm not carrying my baby.
And but it's like, it's abandoned in parts. Like it's dilapidated or whatever. Yeah. And I was thinking, you know, to film up there suddenly gives you, it elevates your film from just being like a normal person on the street to being in an environment that you wouldn't normally go in.
Definitely.
I mean, I need, you know, years of training and very expensive cameras, director of photography, cinematography, gaffer.
But I think if you've got a great idea, that's the basis for every like good film is that the story is good.
Yeah.
So I think if you've got that, then it's just gonna convincing people to come along with you on the ride. And it's, I guess it's probably like any other job where, say like you came up with an idea for not like an awesome car.
Mm.
You'd go and approach people who make cars and be like, I've got this idea for an awesome car. It basically goes underwater, but it's not like the shit one that was in James Bond with Roger Moore.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah, it's proper good.
It's proper good and it doesn't look pants. And they'd be like, you know, like Volkswagen were like, whoa, cool. Yeah, yeah. Because at Volkswagen, like after everything that's happened, we were like quite chilled out now.
Yeah.
And so I guess you'd go over to the car manufacturers and talk to them. So I guess if you've got a good story, go and you want it... recently, I can't remember the name of the book, and I'm kind of halfway through it, and I need to remember the name of the book. There was a guy in France was writing. He was commissioned by the government to write about the environment and everything that's going on over there. He started writing about it and realized that it wasn't just going to be a quick turnaround on a paper. It's a huge topic. And basically wrote this documentary about it. And instead of making it into a film or a TV series, he's made a comic book. And I was like, God, that's really good. You've got a story. Yeah. Instead of just like obviously making it into a film or TV series, you made a comic book.
Yeah.
So I think... if you've got a story, you can just go to wherever you want it to go, whatever medium you want it in, and approach people and be like, look, here's my story. And as long as the story's good, then I think people will jump on board and get in with
it. Okay, as my last question.
Go for it.
Promise.
Yeah.
Last thread.
Yeah.
So the set, the actors, the costumes, the time period that it's set in,
yeah,
is that all after you've thought of a story? Like, what comes first, chicken or the egg?
In this case, it was, yeah. So with Somatic, so I had this idea about, basically, I was like, well, people, I wonder what happens when people get to the end of their lives, and I wonder if they reflect on things, or maybe they don't, they might do. But I was thinking in my late 20s, I was like, oh, you know, I wish I hadn't gone to university and I'd just gone on and done my job. And I was thinking, oh, maybe in your late 60s, what if you, do you reflect more on your life and you wish that you hadn't gone down these routes? And because you've got your whole life behind you, you can kind of see it from a different perspective.
Captain Hindsight.
Yeah, Captain Hindsight rocks up. And so that's basically the main part of the story is someone reflecting on their lives and talking about the good, the pros and the cons of everything. And then to give it a bit more meat, I thought, why don't we set it like why do we have to make it modern? Like it's a story that can fit in any time context. Yeah. And then one thing that did get me thinking was how during the Second World War, you always hear about like these horrendous experiments going on in Nazi Germany, and they were doing this and this to make super soldiers and la 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 la. And then obviously Marvel were like, oh, we got Captain America and we made like super soldier out of that. And I thought, you don't hear too much about in England how, like, we must have been up to no good as well. Like, trying to, if you could get, like, my idea then was if you could get all the old people in England at the time who can't fight because they're too old, if you could somehow turn them around and turn them into, like, soldiers, then you've got, like, a whole new batch of people to go into the army. And the government probably be like, yeah, let's do that. That'd be good.
They're on the last legs anyway. Go on.
Yeah. Come on, just turn them around. Yeah. Get them back. So I just thought, right, if we set it in the 1940s, then we've got like this extra layer of texture to the film. The film's mainly about a guy reflecting on his life, but I wanted to give I wanted to almost give him like a reward for talking about it and a prize, like, you know, sort of a prize to it all. But then thought, I need some way of that to happen. I can't just be like, ha-da-da, there you go. Like, I had to put it in the context of something. So, and then I just thought, like, let's put it in the Second World War. The guy, Dan Ings, who played Dr. Robert Briggs in that, Dr. Robert Briggs was an actual scientist in Massachusetts who was at the forefront of cloning technology. And so I kind of extrapolated him from fact, put him into my fiction, as like an extra layer of like, so if anyone ever knew what his name or whoever looked him up, they would find another layer to all this is going on. So I just tried to kind of onion layer as much as I could without kind of doing too much as well.
Wicked.
Yeah.
Well, no, I don't know, because I think, the reason I ask you is because I find the whole process really interesting. I think the things that are most interesting are honest to you as a person, right?
Yeah.
So people keep banging on about how amazing Deadpool is and how it's transformed and everything. No, it's just honest to its comic book material.
Yeah.
And it's like the podcast that I love, like The Nerdist and Marc Maron.
Yeah.
Like they're so openly honest about the things that have affected them before.
Yeah.
And to me, it feels like it's that Zen point where you're working, but it doesn't feel like work because you're just channeling stuff.
Yeah.
You're not even really thinking. It's just coming. Like the podcast for me is fun.
Yeah.
Like I don't ever stress about it and I really enjoy it.
Yeah.
And the thing when I was thinking about a film and the reason I asked you about personality and is because if someone goes, right, you come up with any idea you want, whatever you want, you just go whoop, straight to the back of your head
and find
that memory that makes you think, oh, it'd be interesting to know a bit more about the history of why things changed.
Yeah,
So I find the fact that you're able to do your own films, you know, why ice cream? Why the ice cream ones?
Yeah. Like, well, that was all, that's on a similar thing, I think. It's like all nostalgia of, you know, being a kid in the 90s and what it was like to go and get an ice cream. And that's all memories and looking back on the past. So I guess maybe there is a... Maybe I'm constantly going to be looking back on everything.
Yeah,
but someone will tell me off one day and be like, "You need to live in the present and like look forward to the future where things will be good." I'll be like, "No. Past is quite interesting, actually."
Have a kid, you'll never be able to not live in the present.
yeah.
Never stops.
It's gonna be at work a lot and then come home late all the time. And then go to work really early.
Best dad ever.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because the reason I want this GoPro is like I just want to be able to film Max.
But.
When I took a GoPro on holiday, like I didn't actually use that many of the films, but the camera shots we got was so good because they're right in people's faces doing the most ridiculous things. Yeah. Like, so this is why I'm in a very, very, very small amount.
There was a YouTube link somewhere. I think there's probably loads of them of when people are setting up time lapses, not just on GoPros, but on other cameras, and the faces of the camera assistants as they're doing it. Yeah. Just looking at it going, and just pulling the stupidest faces. And it's just like, oh, come on, guys. You're going to set up this camera for the first time and you're looking straight at it. Just pull a nice face for the first shot. Yeah, exactly.
So, okay, right. We're going to wrap this up. Cool. What's next?
So next, starting already in a little bit of pre-production of a film called The Lighthouse. A guy that I met through when we were making Somatic, Jack Chapman, who's an actor, is also a fantastic writer, and he's just constantly writing loads of stuff. And he just said to me, "Do you want to read this short film? It was about a guy who lives in a lighthouse, and it's sort of a horror thriller, and there's a twist, and that happens. So we just thought, right, yeah, let's just make that. And like, so we've been trying to finish off Somatic and get all that done at the same time, trying to look into this script and trying to get things going with that, which is really cool. Trying to have like two projects on the go. But then on top of that, Blockstop needed an extra scene for the end of their film because one of their characters became more important and they realized when the first time they did the tour of their play. So we shot that. And then we've gone edited to that. So I've had three things on the go at the moment, which has been a bit bonkers. But yeah, Lighthouse is next. Not sure when we're shooting. Early summer, I think.
And how are you funding that? Is that your own film? It's you and this guy working together, or are you?
Yeah, Jack's doing the Kickstarter for it at the moment. And looking after that. It's a bit tricky after doing Indiegogo of then turning around to everyone and being like, hey, I'm doing another one. So I'm trying to promote it and look after it as much as I can with him, but it'll be really tricky to go and ask people again for loads of money.
So what's your gut feeling with that then? Are you going to actually try and get proper financing through normal channels again, or are you going to go through the whole crowdsourcing?
I think so the Kickstarter has already started.
Wicked.
I think it's been running for like a week now, and I think it's doing fairly well at the moment. I should have looked before I came in, and then I could have given you like stats and figures. 22% of people
Will. Now you've ruined the podcast.
Yeah.
God,
right at the end.
Yeah. Sorry, guys.
How many people got this far and then just went, hey, I wonder how he's doing on his Kickstarter?
Yeah, he didn't even say how much Kickstarter was. What a douche.
I think it's doing fairly well at the moment. And it's like got 20 days on it or 25 days on it left. It was only like a 30-day run.
What's your target?
3.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does this guy own a lighthouse?
Does he own a warehouse? That's what we can turn to. No, so that is... So lighthouses are... I mean, a friend of mine, Sam, is a production manager, and she's working on this as a producer, and she's absolutely fantastic. And we've been looking into lighthouses, and one of the things that she found out is that it's quite hard to get onto a lighthouse. Depending on where the lighthouse is, I think it's slightly easier if you've got a boat, you can get there. But one of the ones we were looking at God Revy down in Cornwall, which looks absolutely beautiful and would be amazing. And I think if we were TV film budget, we would be able to do it. But it's going to be like 6-7 grand to get a helicopter for us to go over to the lighthouse.
A helicopter?
And then we'd have to get gear over there, and then we'd probably have to do a few trips back and forth. And it's just not quite
so
us,
I guess a large part of the film is the seclusion of being stuck in a warehouse. I was just going, there's ones on the edge of hills and stuff, why don't you go in there?
It's fine. I one of the things I really love about making short films is that you've got like no budget, but you know how things are made properly, and you've got proper people behind you and proper cast as well behind you, and you've just got to work out how you're going to make it happen. Like on a bigger film and TV budget, you've got the budget. When you come up with your first idea, that's normally the idea that will then stick of how you're going to make something. Whereas with this, it's like, okay, well, this is how we would do it with big money, and we can't, so how are we going to do it? And then we've got to work it out.
Do you think that you'd have these opportunities if you hadn't have gone to university and come the route you had, if you just literally got out and gone, fuck this, I'm going to make my own films, and just started, you know, made a film? Because I was thinking, like, hindsight, it's all very well to say, do you know what? The first film, I learned so much.
Yeah.
Because you can look back and you're on a trajectory, right? Whereas at the time, if I'm not saying your first film, I'm just saying Afa's film. If it's total shite, you've learned tons.
Yeah.
But at the time, you're in my trough of my, like, I'm shit.
Yeah.
I would just stop. But being in a bigger industry means that, there's this web of people that I'm meeting and getting to know.
Yeah.
So, like, whilst it may have been longer.
Yeah.
think of where you are now? Like, do you think it would have been?
I think university was good for like different reasons. Mm-hmm. Like it probably put me in a different place when I left. Then maybe if I just left, I probably would have been, I don't know, maybe, I think I came out of university and I sort of had that bit of arrogance that I've got a film degree behind me, and then that was just knocked out of me straight away.
Yeah.
That you go and make the teas and coffee. So I was like, ah, okay. But also by then doing that and realizing that I couldn't just go in with a film degree and just start making films, unless I had loads of money behind me, which I know some people have kind of left film school and make films and they do really well because they know the right people. It's really annoying.
Exactly the same in architecture.
Yeah.
I have incredibly wealthy parents and I have every opportunity that you have.
Yeah, exactly. And I've just designed the whole of Northumberland.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things I've always been grateful for with this industry is how it has been tough and it has been a learning curve, and I've had to work my way up the ranks in the camera department. And I've done it because I want to do it and I want to have a career in this industry. And the part of me that wants to be a film director, that's always kind of been there. I've just kind of thought I need to, like, I think it's like with any industry, you need to kind of train and learn and know how every department works. And if you want to be a director of a company, you need to know what everyone's doing.
Yeah.
If you go in as a director of a company because you've got a shitload of money and, you know, someone's giving you some opportunity, that's great, but you're probably not going to be as appreciative of why certain people are doing things, and you're probably going to be a bit of a dick.
Yeah, yeah, massively.
Massively a dick. There were a few people I know who have gone in that way and probably in their personal nature haven't been dicks, so they've been okay. But, like, I've seen it where they've just been, you know, not understanding why the sound assistant is taking so long to put a radio mic on someone. I just get on with it. Blah, blah. Yeah. It's like, no, these things take time. You've got to learn why things take time. And you don't have to know each department inside out, but you need to know what they're doing and how
that's
they're
actually
doing.
That's exactly what these things teach you. You've got to understand why things take time.
Yeah.
Because you're so fucking impatient when you're a kid, especially in this generation where I want everything now.
Yeah.
It's like this is, I mean, I went from having no life projects under my belt to going on to the largest Office Make had ever done, or the City has ever done.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, this is so slow. Like, I just couldn't get my head around how fucking slow everything was.
Yeah, yeah.
And now I'm like, actually, it's quite fast. Like, once you know what's going on in the background.
Yeah.
Okay, I get it now. I get it. But yeah, right. So, and on that note, you should go and watch all his short films because they're wicked. And you're going to come on again in about 6 months, I guarantee.
Oh, probably, yeah.
Please.
I'm just going to hang out in the back of the booth for a bit. I'm not going home. Send my wife a text message. I'm not coming home.
Thank you very much, Will.
Pleasure. Cheers, dude.
Oh, there you go. That was episode 20 with Will Nash. I learned a lot that podcast. That was brilliant. It's funny listening back to it, just how little I realised had gone into making his short film. Not through any fault of his, just that I just wasn't aware of the stuff he'd done. It's really cool to kind of, you know, understand the inner workings of the movie industry. And a big part of the Create More podcast is just the idea that, you know, just keep trying to do new stuff, quite cool stuff, but like stuff that's honest to you, as we were kind of touched on in the podcast, just the idea that, you know, he's doing a film that he wants to do. I find that really creatively open and inspiring in the exact same way that this podcast is. Like, I haven't planned more than a month ahead. Like, I don't know who I'm going to interview. Sometimes I'll sit down, literally read an article or hear someone chatting at work about something cool they saw, and then just get that person's contact details and then interview them. I think to me that is the perfect way to kind of get my creative juices out there. And, you know, to hear him talk in that kind of same way, but that's his actual job. I think it's really cool. I have a lot of respect for him, and it's really hard what he does, and he makes it seem very easy, which is, I guess, the gift of the gab, right? I feel like maybe if you'd put your dreams out there, then maybe people can help. But Will Nash's short film, he wants to do films. I think I just have a love for music videos. I try and explain to my wife that every time I listen to a song in my head that's a music video, all the time, I can't not think like that. If I hear like a really like awesome dubstep song for some reason, I always associate that with some sort of boxing or training montage. So every time the beat kicks in when someone does a press up or punches a punch bag, or as I said, like for my 30th, you know, I always wanted to be a DJ, so I just decided to DJ for a night. And then since that point, every time I hear an amazing like DJ song, like a drum bass or, you know, like a trance song or something, imagine DJing and imagine doing a film or whatever, or listen to some like cool music. I always just think of these kind of weird music videos that I could do. So rambling over, but what I want to do, I'm going to say in a year, how about that for a target? In a year, I want to do a music video on the roof of Ali Pali. Not like a Nickelback talking into the distance, but more like, I haven't really decided, but just kind of like quite an artsy film at night. You know, I think if you've ever been to Alexandra Palace in North London, one of the things I'm obsessed about in London is finding these quiet spaces in the total chaos of London. And, you know, having just had a boy and needing to be out of the house to let my wife go to sleep, you know, I've been up all hours walking around Alexandra Palace at like 6 a.m. when there's literally no one around, and you have a view all across London. And, you know, I've been there on a Saturday and there's thousands of people around. So for me, it's this quiet space. But I know there's if you know Alexandra Palace, there's a transmitter. It's like something like, I'm going to say 80 to 100 meters high, really high, but it has a ladder up there. Spoke to the security guard and I said, can I climb that? And he went, you can't. And I was like, I don't mean me, but can someone, if they have the permission? They're like, well, sure. So I love Ali Pali, want to find out way more about Ali Pali, the history of it. So I'm going to try to sit down and set up a podcast with like the historian of Alexandra Palace, because I'm fascinated by the history of it as well. And part of this is to find out more, again, just because I want to. So I really, really want to do that. So again, I'm going to do a podcast about Alexandra Palace. And then big news, and if you're listening right to the end, then this news is for you. If you're interested in the Brexit Bromain debate, well, my mum, Gisela Stewart, is the Labour MP and is also someone who is now kind of spearheading the Brexit campaign, and over the next 2 or 3 weeks will be becoming more and more prominent in that campaign. And it's really important. I don't really know enough about it. I haven't made a decision to stay or leave, but I know my mum is definitely on the leave camp. So I thought I would sit down. So I interviewed her on the weekend, and it's going to be released next week, so not the 10th, so a week today. We have a full hour talking about Brexit, and I think that'll be part one of two as well. So I'm going to do another one a couple of weeks later. A lot going on. So I really hope you enjoyed it. Thank you so much for listening, and especially this rambling bit at the end. And if in any way you want to help, that'd be amazing. Thank you. Bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Bye-bye.